And stand by, because Dr. Steve Pichenik is coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. That's a little tune from the Electric Light Orchestra. Don't hear too much out of those fellows anymore, but what an amazing band they are. However, while the premise of this song, called Poker, is about everybody going to burn down. You know, I was speaking, a fellow that filled in for me one night, he's a very nice guy, and he does his own show up in the Twin Cities, called Darkness Radio. His name is David Schrader. And we were having a chat a couple of weeks ago. He asked me to come on, and we had asked him to come on Coast, and he did a great job that night. And during the course of our chat, he asked me if I thought that we were entering a different level of darkness. And I don't have very many original thoughts, but or original articulations of thoughts, but I thought I would just share with you what David and I discussed, which is that I believe what we have done when we were is to actually awaken. The awakening that we wanted in 2012, I believe it has occurred. And I believe that what we have awakened to is that we have been and currently are shrouded in darkness. The good part is that it's just squid ink. It's just smoke. The light is there. And the more conversations like these that we have, the more aware we become, the more we awaken, the brighter the light gets. All right, let's do this real quickly and then come back with our guest tonight, Dr. Steven Pichenik. You're going to like this. I think we need his skills now, maybe more than ever. This is Coast to Coast AM. Please stand by. John B. in with you tonight for George Nori. Pleasure to be with you. Dr. Steve Pichenik was the first psychiatrist ever to receive a PhD focusing on international relations. During his career as a senior State Department official, Dr. Pichenik utilized his unique abilities and expertise to develop strategies and tactics that were instrumental in resolving major conflicts in Asia, the Middle East, Latin America, Europe, and the United States. He is currently an advisor to the Department of Defense. And just looking at his professional life history and early life and education, born in Cuba, parents from Russia and Poland, reared in France, the man gets around. Welcome to the program, Stephen. It's great to have you here.
Well, John, I got to tell you, it's quite a surprise and a great honor for me to be on again. Let me just tell you that I didn't expect to say what I'm about to say, because I'm supposed to come on and talk about the complicity and the collusion and the corruption of the government. But your former guest, Michael, is absolutely correct, as you are, John. I happen to be the co-founder and creator with my partner, John Newstead, who was on your show previously a year ago, who's a naturopath, of a holistic company. And we do deal with cancer. And what Michael said and what you said, John, is absolutely correct. I absolutely was shocked that he came on the show and said exactly what I've been saying when I heard about the BRCA1, BRCA2, which I've known about for 30 years in genetic studies, because as an MD and an entrepreneur, I had started up a genetic company 30, 40 years ago. But what Michael said is absolutely correct. The genetic industry is a trillion-dollar industry. But what's worse, in terms of cancer, it is absolutely useless. Having a genetic marker, even a BRCA1 marker or BRCA2 for $3,000 to $4,000, which is patented, and its value is really less than 100, its real value in terms of determining your outcome for cancer is minimal. Now, you don't have to believe me. I'm an MD. I was trained at Cornell and Harvard. But more importantly, I developed a company called MBI Health, MBIHEALTH.com. And your guests and your audience can go to that site and look at our MK4, which we developed for osteoporosis. I didn't mean to come on the show to talk about this, but I couldn't help it, John, because you've done such a brilliant job, along with Michael, of explaining something that's very serious that I have to interject my point of view. And we created MBI Pharma. All of the information about cancer and health products, particularly MK4, which is a form of vitamin K2, for which we, John and I, Newstead, received what was called an orphan drug designation for the treatment of acute myelocytic leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome meant that the FDA said to us, we are in a special category. We did not need a patent. We did not request a patent because MK4 is a natural product. It's a trademark of NBIHealth.com. But we were allowed, if we went through several tests of the FDA, to basically bring it to market. Now, here's the irony, and here's the story, the real-life story of why this business of cancer and genetic engineering is a very dangerous business, not only dangerous in terms of the false profits that it's creating, and they're multiple, they're in the trillions of dollars, Michael's correct, but also it's dangerous to your health. I'll give you an example. JAMA, the Journal of American Medicine Association, said repeatedly in three different articles that a diagnostic determinant or a biomarker for a cancer is not necessarily predictive of that cancer because cancers are multi-determinant, just as Michael said. What's involved is lifestyle, nutrition, stress, everything we talked about in my pharma, NBI Pharma. We received that designation, but we couldn't get the $7 to $10 million that we needed to bring it to market, even though we had everybody on board. Why could not we receive that? Because we said that a natural product, MK4, which is part of our MK4 mini nutrients at NBIHealth.com, was a natural product. It did not need a patent. It was a natural product in the state, and therefore it was looked at by the FDA as a natural product but could treat acute myelocytic leukemia, MDS, which occurs after a treatment of a radiation or chemotherapy on a patient. In other words, what happens after a patient goes into the hospital and receives chemotherapy and or radiation, they eventually develop what's called myelodysplastic syndrome, acute myelocytic leukemia. For that disease, John Newstead and I, as physicians, developed a company which used MK4 to treat people. We treated them at doses of 45 to 90 to 135 milligrams, and they improved. We had a 30-40% improvement rate based on anecdotal material, and we have it on our website. But the point was that we could not use it officially as a medicine because we did not go through the kabuki of putting through a rat test, a dog test, and acquiring all the agents of influence that the FDA wanted. Who were the agents of influence? Oncologists and hematologists who were paid to basically say, yes, this is a good product, and you have to check off the boxes to get it through the FDA. Instead of going through the FDA, John Newstead and I decided to give the entire information to the world for free, and we've been called all over South Africa, Australia, about the treatment of acute myelocytic leukemia, about the use of MK4 for osteoporosis instead of bisphosphonates. Now, I didn't expect to talk about this, but since you brought it up, it's part of this issue of corruption, deceit, and profits. And it's rampant in the medical community, which knows very well that they're doing procedures that are unnecessary. This bilateral mastectomy is totally unnecessary. For whatever reason, Angelina Jolie did it. That's her personal reasons, but she made it a public issue. I think it's a very dangerous issue because women will go in and demand a bilateral mastectomy as a preventative measure. That has no correlation with the occurrence of a cancer. It turned out her mother had ovarian cancer, which metastasized. If you have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, that just simply means that you have a predisposition. However, there are other factors like stress. If increased stress and 24-hour days of work or increased problems in your household or marriage occur, that will decrease your immune system. The real issue is how do you take care of your body in the full concept of health, foods, nutrition. Doctors don't have a concept of nutrition. In 8 years of medical school and other postgraduate school, I never heard the word nutrition once. I never heard the word about natural cares. I never heard the word about a holistic approach. That just is not part of the vocabulary of the MD. Now, I don't say this with any sense of denigration of my field. Doctors go through and basically treat symptoms. We don't prevent things. And what Michael said and what you said, John, is right on the mark, and I hope your audience is listening, because we created NBI Health for that very reason. I was tired of women taking Boniva, Actinel, Physomax, which was creating more fractures than they were preventing. And in turn, we found the studies from Japan that showed MK4 in doses of 45 milligrams a day, taken by pill with no side effects, came out of Japan, reduced fractures by 87%. But MDs didn't want to believe it. Your audience and those in the and the educated consumer who's reading the internet, and that's where I agree with you, John, it is a new day. The light is coming forth. People are beginning to understand they have to be empowered and take care of their own health and their own body politics. Once they began to understand that Actinel, Physomax, Boniva were really dangerous and created osteonecrosis of the jaw, about 4 to 8% of all people going to dentists will have a destroyed jaw because of the products they take. They have to take MK4 as a preventative measure, and dentists are using it. So now we go back to natural products in order to prevent not only osteoporosis, but in order to treat acute myelocytic MDS. But for me to get it to a market to make $1.4 billion, which was evaluated, and instead of charging the $40,000 that the companies were charging for chemotherapy every 2 weeks, I was charging only $69 a month. And I said, this is the only way to go to the people. Let the people determine their own care. Let them read the content and let them go on the website like NBIHealth.com. But I'm so glad you guys brought it up, because I was totally taken aback that this publicity machine or the propaganda machine was going forth. But Michael was absolutely correct. It is a disastrous industry. Now, let me tell you how disastrous it is and what type of a collusion, not conspiracy, but collusion there is between our senators and our legislators and the famous biotech companies. The two most famous biotech companies are Amgen and Genentech, and they like to tell you that they really are the future. What they have done is to create products that are exceedingly expensive and can be easily substituted for far less expensive drugs. But more importantly, despite the fact that they make very high profits on products that we don't often need, they are now asking a request from Senator Max Baucus, who's head of the Senate Finance Committee, for $500 million in support financing because they want to go state to state. And so Michael's point of the patent of the genetic elements is very correct. What's even more important is that JAMA and I and Dr. Newstead and others know very well that the genomic studies, the genome that was done at NIH 20 years ago, by Watson and others, is totally useless. The fact that we know that there's a gene that can cause, let's say, Alzheimer, doesn't mean you can treat the Alzheimer, but it does mean that if you empower yourself and you take a product that we have by chance at NBI Health, Mitofort, which has huperzine A, you have a much better chance of increasing your memory capacity. And if you take, if you do studies and if you do intensive exercises, we know there's neuronal plasticity, which is not taken into account into a genetic marker. So I just want to thank you and Michael for bringing forth this incredible story, which is absolutely true. Obamacare will destroy the medical field. I will tell you now, our premium, our insurances went up. I, who am on Medicare, have been given generic drugs, two of which were totally worthless. One was made in India, and I returned it back to CVS, and I told them that because I'm in the business of nutraceuticals, I knew this product didn't have potency or purity. I could taste it. It was a product that had diesel on it. It had a very poor taste and odorous, and CVS pharmacists agree with me. It was developed by Mylan Pharmaceuticals, and it was bought because it's cheap, and but it was not effective. It was the same thing with another product I had. So I had to go back to the full label ones that were made, which were fortunately made, even though they're more expensive, by our own companies in the United States. I think it's important for your audience to understand that most of the ingredients that come in from India are highly contaminated, as well as they are from China.
And the this FDA is pretty strong is not, stuff, Steve.
I'm sorry.
No, no, keep going, keep going. This is pretty strong stuff.
Well, we have to understand that most of the products cannot be tested by the FDA because they don't have enough inspectors in China or in India to evaluate the contaminated ingredients of what's called the generic products. And the big makers of generic is Teva from Israel and other companies like Mylan here Pharmaceutical, which it says it's made in the United States, but not really so. If you look at the label, ingredients are from India. So the American public and your audience has to be aware of one thing. What are you taking into your mouth? Who's overseeing it? Make sure you understand what's in that pill, be it a vitamin, be it a medicine. For example, in our vitamins, we take four pills a day, which contains all kinds of minerals. It contains all kinds of antioxidants at the clinical dose, not at the FDA-requested dose, but at the clinical dose. So Pfizer, that creates one-day vitamin, is lying. When they say to you, and they say to people under the age of 50, that we have a vitamin that you can take just one a day and can fulfill your needs for that day of the vitamin requirements. It's not true. It fulfills the needs of what Pfizer determines that vitamin to be, but there's no way that you can fulfill the clinical doses that are required where we in NDI Health and my partner, Dr. John Neustadt, who's an MD and a biochemist before and a botanist, basically formulated four pills in order to get the requirements that you need in minerals, antioxidants, and other elements. So the point is here that America is awakening, thanks to programs like yours, George Noory, and others, because they're beginning to understand the government is there no longer to serve them. The government is treating us as if we're dumb rummies. They're treating us with denial, distortion, deception, all across the board. And in medicine, where our health is the most important, the greatest profit margin of all, and this was told to me by the great liberal congressman in Congress, who said to me that there were more profits in the pharmaceutical industry than there was in oil. Now, that's an amazing concept to think about. Yet when I realized that the same company that was making my MK4 from Japan was not using my product in the United States, even though it was a medicine, in Japan, they were making a comparable anti-cancer chemotherapy that they were charging $40,000 for instead of charging the $69 that I charge for this, for a similar product, which is more effective, MK4. But they were using Dacogen, which was using it as an anti-cancer drug and basically destroying the cells, the healthy cells in the body, and creating new cancer cells, so that eventually people would have to come to us to use the MK4 that this very company, Eisai, was putting out in other places in the world. But we, Dr. Neustadt and I, could use that as a vitamin and not a drug. So this goes back to the entire issue of what you have been talking about brilliantly, John Noory has been talking about, Michael, and that is big government. Big government is totally dysfunctional now. Ironically, I'm coming in at a point where I'm in the business as an entrepreneur of creating holistic medicine. But as you said correctly, I come out of the past of having been a deputy assistant secretary of state under Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush. Having been in that business, I understood very well what has been happening to our society, how a man like Obama has become a man who has really expounded the very virtues that he doesn't believe in. When he talks about transparency, he exploits secrecy. When he talks about efficiency, he really embraces dysfunctionalism. When he talks about competency and accountability, there is no competency and accountability. In other words, Obama, be you Republican or Democrat, is an Orwellian dream. He is born and bred, and I said this from the very beginning, of the CIA. His mother, Ann Dunham, was a woman who was trained as an anthropologist and was sent to Indonesia in the 1950s and 60s.
Now, hold on a second, Steve. We got to take a hard break, but you got to stick around for a while. Dr. Steve Pachinik will be back on Coast to Coast AM, Wells and Fornori. Stand by. More to come. Well, thank you very much. One of mine and Dan Galante's favorite songs. Hey, Bulldog. And you can talk to me, and you can also talk with Dr. Stephen Pachinik here in just a minute. I told you I'd sprinkle in a couple of little news things. I'll do them very quickly. Here's a couple from my one of my favorite little websites other than coasttocoastam.com. This is from Full Spectrum Dominance. If you ever want to look at it, just put a dash between Full and Spectrum and between Spectrum and Dominance. It's a nice site. You'll like it. Half of youngsters would swap privacy for, yes, cheaper insurance. More than half of UK youngsters think being tracked is a small price to pay for cheaper car insurance, and 26% will be actively seeking a pay-by-the-mile policy in the hope of saving a few quid. This is slightly disturbing. Actually, I spoke with our friend Alex Jones on his program earlier today, and we discussed a little bit of this. Military says no presidential authorization needed to quell civil disturbances. This is an article by Paul Watson. A recent Department of Defense instruction alters the U.S. code applying to the military's involvement in domestic law enforcement by allowing U.S. troops to quell civil disturbances domestically without any presidential authorization, greasing the skids for a de facto military coup in America, along with the wholesale abolition of posse comitatus. This is a real thing. And you know what they say about religion and politics. If you want to get people into an argument, just start with that. But we tried to discuss issues here that affect Americans. I don't care what party you belong to. It's true, the ones who get it, and the ones who don't get it are probably never going to get it. But I have hope. I have hope, and in fact, more than hope, I have faith that if the disbelievers and the deniers can be shown the truth and somehow persuaded to do their own research so that they can formulate their own opinions instead of repeating things like a bloody parrot, then we might be able to straighten this thing out. But the game is well underway, and we're pretty far behind. So, as ship's Captain Norrie says, as long as I'm allowed to sit in this chair, I'm going to try and bring it to you within the parameters of good taste and within the parameters of what we like to do on Coast to Coast AM. Remember, the truth is out there, and we're going to bring it in here every chance that we get. We'll be right back with Dr. Steve Pachinik in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Steve Pachinik, you're speaking of 24-hour days and causing stress and all that. Just looking over your career here, you were actually at the in 1978. You were actually at the secret meeting when the Camp David Accords were signed, I'm seeing you were a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Kissinger, Cyrus Vance, and James Baker. You joined the U.S. State Department as a consultant to restructure its Office for the Prevention of Terrorism. I mean, this just goes on and on. It's almost a phone book. It's how in the world? I just have to know, what led you into this field? Because it seems like it started out, I mean, this may be a little understated, maybe a lot, maybe even juvenile, but it seems like you started out sort of with a political bent, and then, but simultaneously, you were full immersion into medical research and you have degrees from Cornell and Harvard. I mean, where do you find the time, man? And how did you wind up with this list of credentials?
Oh, John, it's very kind of you. It's really not complicated. I didn't work 24/7. What happened is I grew up with a European background. I was born in Cuba, not because I'm Cuban, but because my father was in the French Army. My family was destroyed in the Holocaust, and my sensibilities were that of coming out of horror, terror. My first memories really of eating with the prisoners of war who were German in France, Germans, and destroyed France in 1945 and 46. When I came to the States, I was very fortunate. I grew up in Harlem, actually, and went to Booker T. Washington, and I had a scholarship to Cornell, and then from there I was able to get to Cornell Medical School. But I always knew that I would become a psychiatrist and a writer. It was always the notion that the refugee really understands the beauty and the greatness of this country, perhaps sometimes without offending anybody, than the American does himself. And as a refugee who was welcomed by this country, I was able to do all the things that I had dreamed of doing, to become a doctor and then become a psychiatrist. But I knew I'd wanted to apply it to international affairs. Now, 30, 40 years ago, that was never heard of. And fortunately, while I was at Harvard, which was okay, not a good, particularly phenomenal school, but really I had more time than one could believe, I went to MIT at the same time and got a PhD from very unusual professors who really understood 30, 40 years ago that there was a natural integration between psychiatry and political science. And there was a very famous author who most people wouldn't know today, but I had met him, was named Harold Laswell, who in 1929 had written a book called Politics and Personality and predicted that there would be a psychiatrist working as a strategist and a tactician in the State Department. And that's what I became. I got a Council on Foreign Relations Fellowship. I was brought on board by Lawrence Eagleburg, a very distinguished and great man who died recently. And my job at the time, and also I was in the military, so I had a very I had the rank of a colonel because I was a medical doctor, but I advanced very quickly where I was able to work on the Soviet Union and the regime change in the Soviet Union because I had experience in the Soviet Union, creating strategic points of tension within the Soviet Union that I could bring out dissidents, particularly Christian dissidents in the 1970s who were being hospitalized by the KGB with a diagnosis that was called chronic schizophrenia. And I wrote about that in a novel called The Mind Palace, which was one of my first novels because I wanted to explain to the American public and the world how the Soviet system was really a totalitarian system, how they were using psychiatry to incarcerate political dissidents. And that was the beginning of my knowledge of how to take down the Soviet Union. And at the same time, I was had the grateful opportunity, Larry said, you know, take over, reorganize what you need to, and gave me a free rein. And as a doctor, you really have the capacity to deal with uncertainty and with crises. That's true of many doctors who've worked in the emergency room. And when we work 24/7 from Friday to Monday night, we don't do that now. You get that expertise of being able to make decisions very quickly in a time of crisis. So there was a very famous siege of Washington at the time called the Hanafi Muslim Siege, where a Muslim took over three, four different buildings with 500 hostages, and I was fortunate to be called in. The FBI called me in, and the U.S. Attorney, Earl Silbert, called me in. And I used the Quran as a way of manipulating the mind the mind of the terrorist at that time. He was called a terrorist. But I had a lot of respect for him, and over 35 hours I was able to help release 500 hostages without any damage. But I did have to be defiant. And that's one of the things that I've always said to our military when I used to teach them at the National War College, that even though I was in the military and I was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, my commitment to the lives of those hostages, and as an American, my loyalty was to the office of the presidency. And my job was to get them out, even though President Carter had ordered me to stand down. I refused to stand down, and I was insubordinate. But in being insubordinate, I was able to save some lives. And I was subsequently known as somebody who could be insubordinate to get things done. It sounds more fascinating than it is. I was just acting as a physician, and I had a moral obligation. And then from then on, when Jimmy Carter got involved in the Iran hostage siege, I resigned and thought he was very incompetent in the handling of that. And I went to the RAND Corporation, where I was asked to develop the architecture plan for the takedown of the Soviet Union. And I spent a year and a half developing about 160 pages using psychological determinants of how we could take down the Soviet Union without any military weapons. And we did, using the economy, the Pope, religion, rock and roll. And it was done with the help of, at that time, some famous...
How big a component was SDI and all that, Steve?
Yes, SDI was an important component. Reagan was a very, very bright individual in terms of foreign policy. What he understood was that we needed what I called the monkey in the box phenomenon, something that was a phenomenon that the Soviets would be fearful of, but we could create and drive up the costs of their system, military system, and that was SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative. And at that time, we didn't really have it, but we, Reagan was so good as an actor and as a president that it really forced the economy of the Soviet Union to bankrupt. And that was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. It wasn't something they gave to us. It wasn't something that suddenly happened. It was a process that was undertaken initially by Brzezinski with covert operations in Afghanistan. It was continued under Reagan. It was really Bush Sr. who completed it. And the entire communist system was finished by the time Baker, myself, and Zelig were there, and the entire communist system came down. So it's not a question of brilliance. It's a question of really understanding psychological dimensions and national character. And that was a field of study that MIT was very, very strong in 30, 40 years ago. And what's ironic, John, and the audience, is that in 1973, to show you how far MIT was, I was already taking the course that was funded by DARPA and the CIA called The Internet and Social Media. That's 1973. And we had never seen the Internet, but already there was discussion then about the impact on a concept called social media. So Mark Zuckerberg and Silicon Valley are really blowing their horns when, in fact, it was really developed by Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency as a way of beginning to understand what was going to happen in the 21st century. It was not a, way to control people. It was really a way of beginning to understand what the future might look like. And so subsequently, I left the government, and I began as an entrepreneur, starting up different companies, radio frequency identification, object compression video, and then this nutraceutical company and the pharmaceutical company. But believe it or not, you can only do this in America. So I agree with you, John. I just want to add that I'm exceedingly optimistic about where we are now and where we're about to go, thanks to George Murray, yourself, Alex Jones, and many others, because we are called the alternative media, but in fact we are the mainstream media, and everybody's beginning to understand that 9/11 is a false flag, the Osama bin Laden story was a false narrative that brought us to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're in a conflict that we had no reason to be in, Syria, where I had been. And so the people of America are waking up. And I agree with you, John. I'm exceedingly optimistic, thanks to people like yourself and George Nouri, and also the fact that we have the Internet and the fact that people are awakening and reading blogs and creating blogs. And they're beginning to understand how corrupt the IRS is, how corrupt our legislators are, how corrupt the White House is, irrespective of what's said. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all right. You have large thoughts. I'm just taking all of this in. You know, you know how you get across thin ice, don't you, Steve?
Yeah.
You just keep dancing, right?
Well, you got to. You have. You're right, John. Either you go through or you just keep going.
Well, yeah, and you know the thing is that there are many, many people out there that feel a deep sense of loyalty to President Obama. So let us just do this. Let's just not speak his name anymore. Let's not single him out because, frankly, with a few exceptions over the string of presidencies that we've lived through, they're the figurehead. They are the great Oz, and don't look behind the curtain. But psychologically speaking, I suppose the short answer is, well, they're true believers. Okay. I answered my own question before I even asked it. But when you have any administration, that the standard answer, anytime something hits the fan and starts getting on everybody, and now all the media outlets are picking it up and they're running with it, because we know that they do. Nobody is going to come on the evening news and say, well, today was a lovely day from coast to coast, and so therefore we're going to go straight to sports, and then we're going to show an old rerun of Leave It to Beaver, because there's absolutely nothing negative that happened, nothing traumatic that you need to know about. How do you reconcile such loyalty when the answers from virtually every department that screws up in government in Washington, D.C. is, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't remember. Well, how is it that people get that mindset? And again, I don't want to pick on the president, because I'm not convinced that he's pulling on the strings. In fact, I'm convinced he's not pulling any of them. Actually, I think he just goes out and tries to do his thing, keep things going. But behind the scenes, we just went through a litany of how powerful the corporations are, what a huge influence money is. Well, we all knew that. I just don't think that any of us were aware that it was being wielded as a weapon against us, with these corporate interests being what they are. How do you persuade people to just look at the facts? Just abandon the fact that, let's pick on Angelina for a minute. Angelina makes great movies. I enjoy her movies. But I'm not going to say that I think that this thing with the double mastectomy was necessarily the way to go. The timing is certainly suspect with all these publications coming out. And then you heard what Mike Adams said, and the rest of the nation did too. So how do you persuade people to look at facts and just sort of let the personality that they adore just take back burner to that?
Well, I think it's an excellent question. One of the ways, number one, I would disagree with you a little bit in that he's far more active than people would imagine. But two, what is created is a narrative. It's a narrative of the Republic or a particular administration. That I agree with, John. And the way you persuade people is you create a counter narrative and you show the inconsistencies in the narrative. For example, 11 years ago, when it was proclaimed that Osama bin Laden on 9/11 attacked the World Trade Center, I came out on the 12th of September, September, and I said, that's a lie. I created a specifically what was called cognitive dissonance. I created a point of fact that either you believe me or not, and I said the following. Not only is he not alive, he's dead, but he has Marfan syndrome. That has to be a medical fact. I didn't make it up. I knew his medical records from the 1980s. And by the way, this was 11 years ago, I said 9/11. By the way, there was a doctor in the CIA who went to see him at the request of President Clinton in Dubai. So that point of fact came in. Most people derided me. They said I was right-wing, I was nuts, I was wacky, just leave me alone. The problem was that 11 years later, as we know, a year ago, when Obama decided, and I made a prediction 11 years ago, and this is the point about creating cognitive dissonance that break people's belief systems. I knew specifically from my experience in covert operations and having worked with the CIA and the DIA and other groups, that they would use the Osama bin Laden narrative in order to justify a war that was coming in. So I predicted two things. One, that there would be a war in Iraq that came a year later. But more importantly, I went on thin ice, as you said, John, and I said that that war in Iraq will end the day whoever will be president will declare that he killed Osama bin Laden. Well, once you put that narrative as a counter-narrative to Osama bin Laden 9/11, 11 years ago, and Alex Jones picked me up 10, 11 years ago, and then replayed it 10 years later, 11 years later, when in fact Obama declared, I, Obama, killed Osama bin Laden, and suddenly you hear the tapes of Dr. Steve Pachinik, whoever he may be, it's not relevant who I was, But the fact that he was a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and predicted that some president would come forth, it created a counter-narrative to what Obama had said.
Gotcha. All right, Steve, we got to stop for a minute. We'll be back with Dr. Steve Pachenik on Coast to Coast AM. John Wells in for Ship's Captain George Norrie. Yes, indeed. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, which you should do every chance you get, certainly once a day, in the news you'll find new fracking rules proposed for U.S. land. That's from the New York Times. How humans will evolve over the next million years. The Internet, a superhighway of paranormal hoaxes and fake lore. That's from the Huffington Post. And the tallest abandoned structure in Russia. And while we're talking about Coast to Coast AM, thanks for becoming a Coast Insider. A valuable service, 3 years of archive shows, very inexpensive, a service I'm sure you will like. We'll carry on with your telephone calls as we make our way through the night. Sitting in for George Norrie tonight, I am John B. Wells, and we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Steve Pachenik. This is Coast to Coast AM. Steve, let's segue over to an item that I wanted to bring up with you. I understand that you have some insight into the security services, specifically the CIA and mind control. Is this are these techniques? Can you discuss any of them? And are they being deployed now?
Well, I could discuss the issues of mind control. That was done in the 1960s. And 1970s by many physicians at Cornell, Harvard, and different areas. I was not into that specifically. Most of the issues of mind control or brainwashing had to do with the techniques that cults use or have been used or being used for torture and interrogation, which unfortunately has been committed under three presidents, Clinton, Bush Jr., and Obama. And what happens, in effect, is You stir up the individual by depriving him or her of sleep. You decrease their nutrient intake so they're barely eating. And basically, you're breaking down their physical and mental capacity. You make sure they're awake most of the time so that there's an incredible need for sleep and they have sleep deprivation. And then you constantly give them other messages which make them supportive of a false interrogator, a false image like a father figure in a cult group, or the good guy in an interrogation versus the bad guy. Those techniques were used very heavily in the 50s, 60s. Unfortunately, they were used through the torture system, but not necessarily mind control, but it was called interrogation or enhanced interrogation and torture. I myself have never used it. I'm not a great believer in it. I don't think it's ethical. And most of the time in COVID operations that I was involved in, which were many, I didn't need to be abusive or in any way interrogate anybody along the lines of a guy like Jose Gonzalez, who claimed he was happy to torture or mind control 30 out of 100 so-called terrorists. The truth is, when you discuss an issue or you question a person, it's much easier to make friends with them and create a relationship than to create a tabula rasa or an empty brain, which you then manipulate.
Before I forget to ask you again, are you giving us MDIHealth.com?
No, it's NDI, Nancy Boy India, NDI, Nutritional Biochemistry Inc., HEALTH.com. NBIHealth.com.
November Bravo India Health?
Yeah, health.com. Yeah, or they call up a number. It's 800-624-1416. That's 800-624-1416. That's Nancy Boy India Health.com.
Oh, well, no wonder I couldn't pull it up. This isn't the most wonderful telephone connection that we've heard. Isn't it funny how calls from overseas are so much clearer? It's extraordinary.
Well, I have to apologize, John. I'm on a cell phone. I don't have a hard line, and usually it's easier for you to have someone on the hard line. So I do apologize to you and your audience for that.
Oh, no worries. I just want to make sure they got your website out. It's like I kept going, well, it's not coming up. I wonder if we busted a server. Okay. All right, that's NNNovemberBravoIndiaHealth.com. You can take a look at it there. Would you care to speculate on some of these things that have been going on around the country? I'm looking at the short list that I have here of what you do when you want to break somebody down. So I'm thinking TV news raises the stress, and you can't sleep. Then you feed them GMOs, which knocks the health down. Then you have the rescuing parent, which would be the government. I guess I'm reaching here, but why not?
John, but, you know, in some ways, the truth is much simpler. I mean, if you look up, for example, Anderson Cooper in Wikipedia, and you know he went to Yale, it says right there he was an intern at the CIA. So when Anderson Cooper gives you a scoop about Benghazi, which is totally a lie, you know he's working for two organizations, CNN and the CIA. I mean, that is not hard to deduce. That's part of the issue that you brought up very well, John, to your audience, that daylight is coming. You just have to be able to empower yourself to look up the various elements on the Internet, and you find out, oh, my God, Anderson Cooper was in the CIA or maybe worked with the CIA. That's kind of a revelation, but it's right there in Wikipedia. So when he comes with a scoop, you become very skeptical. So the narrative, again, you asked me, how do you break the narrative? So the media narrative suddenly is broken when there's an inconsistency. For example, when they talked about Benghazi, Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, and they had inside scoops, none of which were related to the truth. Number one, there wasn't an embassy there. Number two, it really wasn't a consulate. What it was a bunch of houses or rooms where the CIA and ex-special forces were really interrogating prisoners illegally and were shipping armaments to Syria. Well, that didn't come out in the Benghazi reports. That didn't come out in the Pickering Oversight Committee. None of that came out. What the narrative that came out was, oh, there weren't enough regional security officers. Well, that's a lie, because if you know the narrative that the person, you don't happen to know that, but I happen to have known the person who resigned was Eric Boswell, whom I've worked with for 20, 30 years. He was director of the security office, regional security officers all over the world. You know he's a very loyal, methodical, effective individual, and he resigned not because he was ineffective, they weren't enough security officers, but because he had to cover the lies of the State Department and the lies of the White House on Benghazi. The second narrative that came out was that there was a viral video that went viral, and that was broken very quickly. And so you're correct, John, and the audience is beginning to understand that immediately you can break a narrative by beginning to investigate the so-called statements in very fast time. And that's why I'm optimistic, and that's why I'm happy to be on your show to say to the audience, look, it sounds depressing. It sounds like darkness has descended upon us. But the truth is, it really is a new time, and it's a new revolutionary period where we are beginning to use information, self-empowerment, the George Noory, the Alex Jones shows, the John Wells. All of those people are important to us in understanding the message. It's time for you, or me, the American citizen, to begin to empower him or herself by learning what the issues are, by taking some time out, questioning what the statements are, both mine and whatever somebody else says, and then doing something about it. You don't have to write a check. You don't have to run out and shoot a gun. What you do have to do is start to write to your friends, to your senators, to your congressmen, and put pressure on your legislators. And by God, look what happens. You suddenly get an IRS investigation. And then the Associated Press wakes up. Says, oh, they're stealing information from us. Good God, what do you think you've been then? I mean, an axiom, quite frankly, of the CIA and any intelligence organization was this, and this axiom was always true, and that is that reporters and information sources were used for disinformation. That was part of the covert world. And so for the Associated Press to suddenly wake up and say, oh, my God, we've been raped, it's very much like saying you've been in a bordello and you're telling me that you didn't know that you were there to service the various individuals, and you can't be righteous about it. So I have no pity, although I'm shocked that they were stupid enough to do this. But in fact, most reporters and most journalists have to have access to the government. In order to have access to the government, they literally have to do, quote, I have to put it up, suck up, or be able to offer themselves in some way, become vulnerable to the person giving them information. And that is a two-way street. It's symbiotic between government officials and reporters. So for reporters to suddenly become self-righteous and say, my God, I was raped by the government, that's a little bit over the top. The truth of the matter is that reporters have a very symbiotic relationship with government officials, and government officials in turn become reporters or utilize them. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship, but disinformation is part of that relationship. So that's very important for the American public to understand, that the people in the covert world of the security will have no qualms about disseminating disinformation. As you would say, John, that's brainwashing or someone else. And in the covert world, they would say, well, that's propaganda. And every administration, where you're correct, John, is that it doesn't matter whether it's Obama, Clinton, or Bush, or any other president, they each had a narrative that they wanted to be remembered with. And in this case, Obama had a narrative that was the Obamacare, and I've done the following, and so on and so. But the reality is that so many realities have come forth because of the Internet, because of the immediacy of crises, because of Syria, because of Benghazi, because of the IRS, that suddenly with technology and a certain amount of awareness, people are saying, wait, that narrative doesn't work. So the narrative changes. But the people who are in government haven't changed. John Brennan, who was head of counterterrorism for Obama and was involved in the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden, which is a fake narrative, and then was involved in covert operations in Iraq with the drone wars, which were illegal and killed 348,000 people. He's not accountable. He was made director of the CIA. So the narratives continue. They may be disrupted, but what's not disrupted is the fact that the American people have not held any of our officials accountable. For example, and you know this to be self-evident, none of our bankers, despite the travesties and criminal activities that Goldman Sachs committed, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America have all committed, not one banker has been put in prison, including Corzine, who was a former senator and governor of New Jersey, and he had MF Global that went under, and he destroyed the contracts of 40,000 farmers of Montana, yet he was not put in prison. Goldman Sachs that bet against their own security mortgages and shorted them. In other words, destroying their own assets in order to make money twice, were never accused, were never put in prison, even though they were questioned by Senator Levin, who said this is criminal. J.P. Morgan Chase questioned by Senator Levin. So the American public has not really demanded that there be an accountability and prison. Prison for officials and prison for those who've committed the acts of criminals. And once that's gone, the system says, you know what, nobody cares. So there's no accountability for a government official. It doesn't matter whether it was Clinton, Bush Jr., Obama, or Cheney. They go away, they write their novels, or they write their autobiographies, which really amount to novels, and they go on to make a fortune.
Isn't that true? Isn't that they do amount to novels, don't they? You know, on Friday night, Steve, we always take some calls. There's several people who would like to speak with you. If you're all right with that, we'll take a call right now. Let's talk to Rand out of New York, New York, on wildcard line number two. Rand, if you're still there, thanks for holding, and come on.
Hey, guys. You know, I moved to New York from Austin, Texas a couple of years ago. I was in Austin, and 9/11 happened in 2001. And I always knew it was a lie. I mean, from the minute they were finding the passports and the rubble and, you know, Building number 7 going down, I mean, global symmetrical collapse at free fall speed. I mean, it was like, you know, wait a minute, you know, why isn't this being shown on television? It's the strangest anomaly the whole day, this 47-story building that just happened to have the biggest, you know, CIA office outside of Langley, comes crashing down at free fall speed, and they don't even show it on television. I moved to New York 2 years ago, and I'm just completely blown away by how many people in this city don't know about building number 7, the third building to fall. I mean, my own doorman here doesn't know. And, you know, I just wanted you to expand on your statement that you thought it was a lie, Steve. I would really like to hear you say, tell us, you know, like, who you think was behind it.
I said it from day one, who was behind it. It was a stand down. There was no secret. I mean, 40% of the American public, other than New Yorkers, now know it. George Bush needed a his own death or a reason to go to war, which he already concocted way before he came in with the neocons, Wolfowitz, Steve Hadley, Richard Perle, Rami Hollis, all the guys I've worked with and didn't agree with him, including Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. They created what was called a stand down, where they allowed planes to come in, and they created a situation where the World Trade Center and several other buildings were destroyed. But again, the narrative here doesn't work, as you pointed out. Only a good Texan from Austin could tell, again, that the buildings, all you have to look at the engineering requirements, that buildings can't collapse in 8 seconds. You don't have explosions every 20 feet, and no planes can destroy an individual building. But I said it then, that this was a false narrative that was used to create a purpose to go to war in Iraq, where we failed. And again, where we went to war in Afghanistan, where we failed, and where Bush Jr. as well as Clinton both created this narrative about the war on terror, which is an oxymoron, because in the world of psychology, and I was one of the first counterterrorist experts, you don't create a war on an emotion. Terror is an emotion. I can create terror without even destroying anything. The fact is, the attack on 9/11 was not a terrorist attack. It was an act of war, which is very different from a terrorist attack. A terrorist attack is when I create fear, and I resonate that fear through the media, like Boston Massacre, which was a disaster of handling by both the White House, the Mueller, the FBI, where there was literally a lockdown of a town of 4 million people. That's an act of terror. An act of war is when you literally go to war. And Bush was so stupid, and so were the people at the CIA. No, I mean it. I mean, if you're going to have a narrative, you got to be smart about your narrative. If you want to write a novel, and that's really what a narrative is, Bush Jr. and Cheney were not very bright. I've known Cheney and Rumsfeld since the Nixon days. These are not the brightest individuals. They are lethal, and they are ruthless. They have no qualms about killing 3,000 of our Americans in order to go the war for the military-industrial complex, in this case, oil and Iraq. Iraq wasn't relevant to them. Saddam Hussein was just an excuse. And the rest is commentary. But the narrative was very simple. Now, the question that you asked specifically is, why don't people want to believe it? When you change your belief, you have to take responsibility. And to take responsibility for defying a government, particularly the American government, where we say, God bless America, and I stand for the Republic, is very, very hard for an individual to do, particularly on 9/11. Despite the fact that you were aware of it, and many others, that there was an inconsistency and a logic in the narrative, and it didn't make sense, most people had to come to the conclusion that, look, my government could never do this. And this was true about people close to me, both friends and family members, who really didn't want to listen to it. And for years, I really had to kind of go away and be kind of a renegade of the family or the Washington, D.C., because I wasn't there to just proselytize. I was there to call the cry for freedom, to say, look, this is the beginning of a very disastrous cycle of events that will occur in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and created by the CIA for the CIA and military. I can give you a whole list of names and units that were involved, but that's been said before. But the question then became, well, what do we do about it? Have we brought Bush Jr. to justice? No. Have we brought Cheney to justice? No. Have we brought Condoleezza Rice to justice? No. Colin Powell, who said in front of the UN and to the world, look, I have anthrax in my hand in a bottle. He was clearly lying. But I've known Colin Powell for 20 years. He's lied for 20 years.
Steve, hang with us for another half hour or so, will you?
Sure, no problem.
We're going to take some more calls, and then after that, it's all you. John B. N. for George Norrie tonight. This is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return. This one kind of came out of left field, didn't it? Yes, it did. Well, every once in a while, you just got to hear a little Nancy Sinatra in that great Bond film, You Only Live Twice. I saw a photograph of Sean Connery. He's 82, and he was in New York, and he looks like a very wise Mr. Bond at this point. And you know, I was wondering, I thought to say, what about Hackman? What's going on with Gene Hackman? I haven't seen anything out of him for a while. Mr. Hackman is now 83. May both of them be blessed. They produce some good art and some great entertainment, and they are now permanent fixtures in motion picture history. Okay, well, we got a full bank of calls here, and we'll get right to them. Let's take our quick little floating break and carry on conversations with you, and our conversation, a most singular conversation, with Dr. Stephen Pachenik on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. You know, it's my fault because I talk sometimes. Some people say too much. And frequently our guests have large thoughts and they need to be expressed. But I'll tell you what, we're going to get as many of your calls in as we possibly can with Dr. Steve Pachenik right now. Let's go to wildcard line number 3, Sharon in Springfield, Mo. How are you, Sharon? Thanks for calling. Thanks for holding. What's up?
Hello, Mr. Wells and Dr. Pachenik. I alternate between cold rage and nausea with what's going on in this country. I love America. But I feel like I need to vomit up a boulder-sized chunk of garbage all the time now.
No, that's a frightening visual, Sharon.
Yes, well, it's a frightening feeling.
Yes.
I have a question, Dr. Pachenik. Could you please tell me your opinion of the Oklahoma City bombing?
I have to be very frank. I know very little about the Oklahoma bombing and McVeigh. I know what many people say, but I really don't know very much about it. My expertise was in foreign affairs and international terrorism, so I really can't answer you very intelligently.
I hate for you to hold that long, Sharon, without getting the answer to your question, but if you have another one, we'll entertain that one.
Okay. I have asked this question on other shows. When was the last time that anyone has heard anyone in this administration take responsibility for anything? When was the last time you have heard anyone in the Congress take responsibility for anything?
Well, it's been a while, Sharon. The last time in my memory would be Richard Nixon, when I think 3 of the 5 articles of impeachment had been pretty much given a green light, and he went ahead and resigned, so no impeachment was necessary. But that's the last time I can remember any government official taking responsibility for anything. What do you think, Steve?
I agree with you. I think that's a sad commentary, but it's true. I was in the Nixon administration, but the impeachment process was the last time of accountability. We haven't had it. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, well, even Mr. Nixon, he decided to, you remember the 60 election was, he decided not to contest it in the interest of the country.
Well, you know, one of the things I think our listeners and your listeners really have to begin to understand is that it's true. Many things do not seem very good. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly. But you have to remember that we're a young country relative to the world. We're only 200 to 300 years old as an experiment in democracy. And we've done really quite well, despite the fact that we've had leaders who've lied, who've deceived, some who, despite their own insecurities and infirmities, have really allowed us to progress. And the truth of the matter is, the government is not the key issue in the United States. What is the key issue is really the individual and the entrepreneurs and the things that we as individuals do for ourselves. So the small businessman, it's not Wall Street that will determine the outcome. It's the small businesses. And small meaning anything that's legally below $500 million, although it sounds like a lot. That's the real determinant of the outcome of this nation. I have more hope than most people only because I see all kinds of constructions going around me. There are constructions underneath the ocean, above the ocean, on roads. I see young people developing new companies. I see all kinds of ideas being developed and then discarded. I hear, you know, George Murray. I hear Alex Jones. So, you know, on the one hand, it sounds terrible and things appear worse than they are. But quite frankly, the nature of our democracy is really centered around the notion that we have to fight for that. It's not given to us. Thomas Jefferson made it very clear many, many centuries ago that each generation must fight for their own democracy. It doesn't mean we have to go into the field and use guns. It means that we do have to question the authority of the state. There's an inherent tension between government and its citizens. We have a social contract. The government has become too big, too out of control. So in turn, what you're seeing now is the struggle of the people saying to the government, no. You cannot continue. You cannot grow at the expense of our own welfare. I find this to be very healthy. The truth of the matter is, if we did not have resistance and we did not have the struggle, I would find that very unhealthy. For example, take China in reverse. You know, it's called a communist country and all that. Their biggest problem is far, far greater than you can imagine. It's two issues that we're not concerned about. One is water. China has no water west of the Yangtze River, and that's a 500 million people that are bereft of water. And the second issue for China is control, social stability. We don't have that issue because no government, no matter how big you think it is, can control a country which literally has more rivers and more land beneath it than anyone can imagine. It takes us 10 days by car, night and day, to go to the east or the west coast. So I'm far more optimistic about our nation and where we're headed than I am about Europe, China, Africa, or the Central Asian republics, because we're continuing to grow. Europe is not. It's falling apart. No matter what you see and what you think, Germany and France still fighting it out over the euro. Russia has become an oligarchy and the return of a czar. You've had Turkey become a predominant power. You have the Shiites and Sunnis fighting in the Middle East no matter what is said to you. We have no interest there. We have no interest in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have no need for 733 bases in 220 countries. So we're going to downsize our military. We're going to take away their armaments. We're going to take away the military-industrial complex, which holds each one of our congressmen hostage to their whims and ways. I mean, we don't need to build M1 Abrams anymore, the tanks. And so a senator like Portman can't get away with building M1 Abrams tanks when, in fact, the Defense Department says we don't need tanks. So the system needs to struggle. It needs to argue within itself. I find this helpful. And that's what our founding fathers were all about. They didn't agree with each other. But throughout our generations, we've always had a fight between the states' rights, federalism, the citizen, the rural versus the urban, and sure, so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
So I see optimism here.
You know, that's excellent because that's what everybody wants. We want a resolution, but you know what? I think we don't mind a good fight. Not necessarily. I'm not talking guns and knives here, but I mean engage and be motivated to want to engage, not to just sit there. Hey, guys, I want all the guys to hold their position there, but ladies first. Let's talk to Diane. She's in Santa Barbara, California. So welcome, and thanks for calling.
Hello, John. Hi, Doctor.
Hey.
Oh, my God, Doctor. I think I could talk to you for hours because you're so I'm just a all over the Obama's history, and it sounds like you were very involved with the government right about the time when he was working for Business International Corporation and with Brzezinski, and all those guys. And I think my theory, and I want to see if you agree, that he made his trip to Pakistan as a special rapporteur for the UN, and also the fact that Business International Corporation wrote a book, which I actually bought in 1968, the UN and the business world. And it's incredibly, I mean, I have that thing, you know, dog-eared all the way through, but it's a fascinating book. But I was just wondering if you have any insight on that.
Well, let me just clarify 2 points. Number one, it's no secret. You can look up his mother's involvement in the CIA. She was recruited to be a CIA in Indonesia. She spoke Indonesian. She spoke Russian. She was not just a hippie. His maternal grandmother was a banker in actually one of my regional areas, which is the Hawaii East-West Center, which is a CIA funding site. And his maternal grandfather, who fought in World War II, was in the CIA. He worked for Peter Geithner at the International Business Council, the Asian Business Council, which you talked about, which is a CIA cutout. Peter Geithner, Tim Geithner's father, was a CIA operative. That's not a secret. And then Obama went to Occidental College, which is totally plastered with ex-CIA operatives and that were now professors. You can look it up. It's in Los Angeles, not far from you. So it's not something that's amazing. It's just amazing that he never disclosed any of this, and the fact that he's not proud of his own mother, when in fact the distraction was he's talking about his father in Kenya, which was really not the issue. The issue was, why haven't you talked about the fact that you were born and bred of the Central Intelligence Agency? It's not something you'd necessarily be ashamed of. Why aren't you talking about the fact that you worked in Pakistan and elsewhere for Peter Geithner? And, you know, you don't negate your own history and make it exclusive and say to people and talk about transparency. That's what I talk about, John, that you brought out about. Well, where's the inconsistency in the narrative? Well, the inconsistency is when you talk about transparency and you don't want to reveal anything about your background, forget where you're born or anything like that, but what you studied, and you want to classify the fact that you went to Occidental, you may not have gone to Occidental, and then you went to Harvard, but that's the only thing we know about, but we don't know about your travels. That's inconsistent. When you talk to me about, you know, I care about democracy and I care about freedom and all, and then we have the most repressive rules that have come in terms of monitoring our own freedoms and information, and you find out that they're really piercing the corporate umbrellas in terms of secrecy and piercing into the IRS, through the IRS, into various conservative organizations, then you say, wow, this man is totally inconsistent with what he says in terms of his narrative. Therefore, we have to assume he's a liar. If he lied once about Osama bin Laden, he's going to lie again and again and again. And sure, you don't have to be a psychiatrist to say that. That was true of all our presidents.
Thanks, Diane. Steve, let me ask you something. Sure. Finish that thought, and then I got a question for you.
Sure.
No, go ahead and finish your thought.
My point is that the American public has to awaken to the narratives that are being told to it. And it's not a question of saying, oh, well, that's nice. It's a question of saying, well, what does that really mean? And how is it that if you give me a narrative A, how come there's an inconsistency? And that's all you really have to begin to do. Begin to question the people of authority, even me or John or George, whoever it may be, and you find out within one or two questions, as you would in any business interview, you know, where have you worked? What exactly did you do? What is your background? When you find out, well, Obama hasn't had a very extensive background of any working, neither was Bush Jr., neither was Clinton, you say to yourself, well, these are all political animals, one out of Arkansas, the other one so-called out of Texas, and the third one out of wherever he came from, and you say to yourself, well, if politics is the only thing you know, then you haven't really run anything. You haven't been accountable for any business affairs. You haven't been accountable for people, so you don't really know how to manage. That was not a very difficult observation to make of the three presidents or many of our presidents. So,
well, you know, and it seems to me, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it seems that the people are concentrating more on expending their energy opposing those that they perceive to be ideologically opposed to them, when we're actually all in the same boat and we're really not focusing on who our leaders are, because we have our bent, whatever it is, and then we have the dog and pony show up there that keeps us distracted. It's like we want to roll with this program. This sounds really good. And anyone who opposes what appears to be a good thing, anyone who says, hey, you know, I'm not so sure about this, well, then all of a sudden now they're the target of the research rather than the government authority. You mentioned Los Angeles. Let's talk to Charles very quickly. Charles on wildcard line number two in LA.
I wanted to ask Steve, in December of 2001, after the Trade Center fiasco, our Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, announced that Osama bin Laden had died of kidney failure. Would you comment on that?
Yes, she was correct. Osama bin Laden had already died because he had Marfan syndrome, M-A-R-F-A-N. If you look it up in Wikipedia, you will see that Marfan syndrome is a disease which affects the arteries, including the kidneys specifically. It affects the long bones. You have a very long jaw malocclusion. You can look at Abraham Lincoln. He had that. And you have a very short lifespan. Basically, renal disease will come and terminate your life. And he had renal dialysis machine. It was not an accident that El-Zawahiri, his number two man, so-called terrorist as well, was a physician and still is an MD. And matter of fact, as a footnote, most of the terrorists that I dealt with overseas in the Middle East and elsewhere are physicians and doctors, MD. George Habash, Bashir Assad of Syria is an ophthalmologist. The people in Iraq are neurologists. And so contrary to what we have in the United States, where we have lawyers dominating our system, medical doctors have far more prominence in the world, third world, and are really in use terror as a technique than most others. And by the way, I think the audience should understand, the use of terror is 96 to 98% effective. That is, when you create a point of terror in the world, whether it's by an explosion, an IED, or psychological, it's very effective. It's intended to create fear. It's not intended to go to war, destroy a building. It's intended to create fear. So fear was created in 9/11 sufficiently enough to go to wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So who did we kill last year?
Last year we killed nobody.
Well, the Osama bin Laden event, you mean that didn't happen?
That was a narrative. No, that was a false narrative that was created by Admiral Mullen and Special Forces Chief McRaven and Jose Gonzalez, where the CIA created this incredibly false narrative of a man who was found 10 years later who already had died of kidney failure and Marfan syndrome. And then they had to explain the narrative went dead when, in fact, they tried to explain to everybody that Osama bin Laden was buried in the sea, which was absurd, and his body was cut up, and then his pieces were taken to Walter Reed. So the narrative fell apart, and the narrative fell apart because people like I predicted 10 years beforehand, and Madeleine Albright said that the man had Marfan syndrome. He was dead, and he had been dead, and he would be pulled out as an object of once we left Iraq.
Unbelievable.
So we didn't kill anybody. That narrative,
thanks a lot, Charles.
Such a ridiculous narrative. It was made into a movie, which was also ridiculous, Zero Dark 30. And Jose Gonzalez, who created that false narrative, had to, and also, by the way, leaked out covert secrets. He was the head of the CIA, Director of National Intelligence Operatives, literally gave the storyline to Catherine Bigelow and her co-partner.
Steve, do you have to go, or can you stay till the other side of this break, or do you need to go?
Yeah, I can stay.
All right, hang on. We'll be right back with some more of your calls. It's not fair to leave you on hold all this time. You don't get to talk to Dr. Steve Pachenik, so you will. And then the last hour is all yours. Okay? Okay. John Wells in for George Norrie tonight. Good to be here with you. Good to have you with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you very much. You know, as we go on through the evening, you might want to check out Dr. Steve Pachenik's Websites, stevetalks.tv. Yes, stevetalks.tv. And then NBI Health. It's NovemberBravoIndiaHealth.com. NBIHealth.com. Check it out. Some more calls and some more Steve in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Hang on. Well, this is just a little news thing here. Two commuter trains serving New York City collided in Connecticut during this afternoon's evening rush hour, sending about 60 people to the hospital, including six with critical injuries, Governor Daniel Malloy said. About 250 people are on board the Metro North trains, one heading east from New York City's Grand Central Station to New Haven, derailed about 6:10 p.m. just outside Bridgeport, MTA and Bridgeport officials said. So if you're up in that part of the world and you wondered what that was, well, that's what it was, and the route has been closed indefinitely. Don't know when it'll reopen. We're with Dr. Steve Pachenik right now, and just very, very quickly, Steve, because we've got I don't want to drag you into a long one here, because a bunch of people still want to talk to you. But you know, if that Osama bin Laden thing was a staged event, then do you have any thoughts? And if you don't, it's perfectly okay. I'm not trying to pull you into one of those jackpots, but what do you make of all these shootings like Aurora, and then this thing at Sandy Hook, and then this marathon bomb, where the last thing I heard about is that one of the two brothers that was captured in the boat had scrawled his bye-bye message on the inside of the cabin with a Marxalot that I guess he found lying around there, you know, admitting that he had done this and his ties to that and so forth. And it just seemed like, oh, really? He left a note?
Well, yeah. But let me just quickly state this. Aurora was definitely a massacre, which was committed by a person who was not mentally incompetent. I was indirectly involved in just making that determination. As for Sandy Hook, that was a false flag. I can understand that. That was totally a false narrative. It didn't occur. There was no Asperger's individual. There was no mother who created a kid who gave her guns, and she was an alcoholic, and he came in and shot 33 PS students plus six more in 3.5 minutes. All kinds of shotguns. It's just not possible. The narrative made no sense, and now they've taken down the school, and they paid $63 million, and the state of Connecticut knows very well this was not even in existence. And I'm a liar. I mean, that's why I continuously say the man's a pathological liar. As for the last Boston massacre, I really indict Mueller, the FBI, and really go back to the CIA. When you hear anything about Chechens coming to the United States or Uzbekis, that has to do with consular officers overseas, U.S. Foreign Service consular officers who are usually covered by the CIA, and that usually deals with the CIA operatives who are involved in either Chechnya, Dagestan, or Central Asian Republic. And was a total a mess up by the FBI, the CIA, and there were lies there. So again, gotcha. What happens is the lie, the pathology, the corruption, the distortion continues from Osama bin Laden to Sandy Hook to Boston Massacre. And the government keeps on repeating its narratives that are false, inconsistent, and finally they get caught. You know, it's like the bank robber. When John Dillinger was caught by the FBI, they said to him, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. Well, right. This president keeps on creating lies, distortions, and occasions for conundrums and fights because that's all he knows. That's what he's continuously doing on behalf of the military-industrial complex. Now, let's make that very clear. That's a huge military complex with a military that is overblown, very dysfunctional, and really has to be taken down very seriously.
Gotcha. All right, so, let's grab another one real quick as we start, as we're turning into our depletium here. Mike in Livermore, California on Wild 5. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing great, John. How are you, John, Steve, or Doctor? Oh, what a wonderful show. You had mentioned earlier something, I may have heard it wrong, a scholarship or something from the CFR, which would be the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
I take it. Okay. What can you tell us about the influence of the Council on Foreign Relations on presidents going all the way back to, what, Nixon, Johnson, and its connection with the CIA?
Well, I can tell you very much. I had left the council about a year ago because it was totally dysfunctional. In the early years, the council was created by the Rockefeller Foundation. It was created for the sole purpose to have a body of knowledge where officials, former former officials and future officials would get together and discuss foreign policy. Most of our presidents were either involved in the Council on Foreign Relations, but its influence has really waned. There have been many councils and many think tanks. The Rand Corporation was influential 30 years ago. It's not now. A Council on Foreign Relations has a very large body of people that really is not influential. You have the American Enterprise Institute, where you have people like Paul Wolfowitz and others. That's far more influential. Heritage Foundation, where Jim DeMint is now the head of the ex-senator, that's very, very influential. The Brookings Institute, which is run by Stroke Talbot, that's very influential. So there are many think tanks that, in my opinion, are far more influential in the Washington, D.C. parties than the Council on Foreign Relations. It basically ended up to be a nursing home for those who have want to talk about old stories and old tales. I left. I mean, I didn't want to fund it. I didn't really get anything out of it. I think it's totally dysfunctional. In the earlier days, it had a purpose. It had a meaning. It was not the inner government, but it was more exclusive and more discreet in its knowledge and the base in which it culled individuals from. It gave me the opportunity to come in apolitically into both Republican and Democratic institutions. But as it evolved, like most institutions, it became dysfunctional and disorganized and really not relevant.
Gotcha. Hey, Phyllis on wildcard line number one in Aurora, Colorado. Welcome, Phyllis.
Welcome.
Phyllis.
Well, I'm not Phyllis, but I'll be for if you want
You don't
me
sound
to
like a Phyllis. Good grief.
But Steve, I can go along with your false narrative on the Osama thing, because with that helicopter being taken out with the SEALs over Afghanistan to silence maybe some of the people who are really SEALs then, that makes you wonder. But I cannot, because I've got a CIA, a retired CIA and his friend from Schreiber Air Force Base in NORAD, and a current, I won't say what that one is, at the CIA Computer Center here in Denver. Both of them say, no way, Obama CIA, Communist Party, Steve. That the whole thing about Business International Company, it wasn't a CIA front like his one guy put out there on the Internet. It was a Communist Party front. Frank Marshall Davis, Communist Party USA. Who supports Obama? Look at Robert Bauer, his chief attorney with Perkins Coie LLP. The voted communist and his wife, Anita, who loves Mao. There's no way this guy's CIA, Steve.
Well, okay. I mean, I'm not going to argue the point, but you just go back to his mother, who was CIA, his grandmother, who was CIA and grandfather. I just make the case. I think you have a point, but I can't argue the point at this point. I'm just telling you that his teachers at Occidental, if you look at them very carefully, I don't want to name them right here, they were ex-CIA operatives, and they're well known in the covert community. It's not a positive or negative. It's simply a point of fact that he went to Occidental in Los Angeles, and you can look it up and you'll see who his teachers are. And they are CIA operatives. It wasn't a secret. So you may have a point, whatever your friends have said, but truthfully, that's not the case.
Roger on the international line. Let's bring him on from Toronto, Canada. Roger.
Hi, everyone. Doctor, I was just wondering what your assessment is of the Jimmy Carter presidency, because his reputation seems to be getting better as time goes on.
That's an excellent question. You know, while I was there, I was not enamored of Jimmy Carter because he was a strong micromanager. But truthfully, as the years gone by, he's done a lot. I mean, number one, he really initiated the Camp David Accords. No one deserves more credit than Jimmy Carter. So I have no idea why the present presidents don't ask him for that assistance. Number two, he did fire over 4,000 CIA operatives, correctly saying we don't need them and what we have are political officers. Number three, he did initiate human rights. At the time when it started with Pat Darien and Harding Carter, even I was a little bit confused to the effect that it would have on a foreign policy, but only in retrospect, years later, did that become a very essential element in the takedown of the Soviet Union and Bill Gates, the DCI, Director of Foreign Intelligence Agency, also agreed. I would consider Jimmy Carter, despite some lapses on the Iran hostage and the domestic policy of where the interest rates went up to 80-90%, one of our greater presidents in the past 30 years. I agree with that.
Very interesting.
I know it's bizarre, but at the time when I worked with him, I didn't feel that, and I resigned. But in years later, when I looked back, I said, this is a man who had a strategic vision, had tactical capability, and though he was a micromanager, really was able to accomplish quite a lot in the few years he was there, and he came out of nowhere and had conviction, and he still does. So I have to objectively say that he was quite effective. I would say that Bush Sr. was very effective in foreign policy. For example, he took down apartheid, never said a word. He really was instrumental in implementing the Reagan Doctrine on the Soviet Union. He was exceedingly effective. He took down East and West Germany, Berlin. He was the one who did that. He took down many of the Central American elements. He had other issues, but you know, in many ways, he gets far better in foreign policy than anybody gives him credit for. Certainly better than his sons, and certainly better than his successors, Clinton, Bush Jr., or Obama.
Gotcha.
And so, he is quiet. He doesn't say a word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. First time caller, Wendell in Blountville, Tennessee. How are you?
Hello, Mr. Wales.
Good
Hello,
evening.
Doctor. Thank you for taking my call. Greetings Great. From the home state of Harrod Baker. My question would be a simple one. I would want you to ask first, which you've explained a lot of, but what is your agenda, if you have one, and could you explain it maybe in the terms that the common man would understand? And two, did I understand you to say that Sandy Hook was not real and there was not children killed at Sandy Hook?
That nobody was killed. It was a totally false narrative. But let me go back to my agenda. My agenda is very simple. I served our country as both a military officer and a senior official in the State Department, but I really left to become an entrepreneur and a physician. My agenda was very simple. I just wanted to be an American who stood up and said, look, this 9/11 is false. We've killed our own people, and we're going to create more disasters and self-destructive elements. And my agenda is very simple, to stop our government from self-destructiveness and imploding and having this country implode within. We don't have foreign enemies. We weren't attacked from abroad. The only enemies we have is our debt and our resources that are being utilized for war. We don't need an army that big. We don't need 2.2 million. We don't need a CIA that's out of control. I don't need 16 intelligence agencies that are dysfunctional. I don't need an IRS that's dysfunctional. So my agenda is very simple. I'm an American citizen. I stood up as an American citizen. I was formally brought to charges on treason as an American citizen because I worked against George Bush Jr., and I said he has to go for what he did. But I'm more than happy to stand up again and say, look, this is enough. As an American citizen, I will fight every effort the government makes to repress me and suppress me. That's it. As simple as that. I'm an everyman guy. I am as simple as that. I have to work every day. I have to be accountable. Nobody's ever given me money. I was asked to be promoted to Brigadier General. I refused. I didn't receive a pension from the government. And I have my own businesses. That's all I am.
Just sounds pretty good. It's enough to keep you busy. All right,
well,
we've got time for one more. That's going to be Renee in Tucson, Arizona. Renee, are you there?
For taking my call, Mr. Wells, and
you got it.
Hello to Dr. Steve. My question is, Dr. Steve, do you think that, as they did in Russia, the psychiatric community in league with the pharmaceutical companies are being used on political dissidents as the, a way of shutting them up?
Well, let me get it. What I want to say is, no, I don't think we use the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry in the way Russia did to deal with political dissidents. But I do believe that my psychiatric profession has to examine itself, particularly with the forthcoming book that's called The Diagnostic Statistical Manual 5, where they've created all kinds of labels and diagnoses that don't exist, and they were criticized correctly by the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, saying, guys, this is not a consensus of people who are working for these drug companies, but you need more scientific evidence. So I am critical of my own field, psychiatry, to say we're out of control and that we need more science and less diagnostic criteria for making money. But we're not using it for dissidents. We're not capable, we don't know it, that's not an issue here. What's an issue is that we have a dysfunctional psychiatric system and a dysfunctional pharmaceutical industry that's making a fortune and creating drugs that are not well understood, but we're not using it for political purposes.
You know, I was just curious, earlier you mentioned Mr. Gonzalez. Did you mean Rodriguez?
I'm sorry, you were right.
No, that's all right.
No, you're right,
No, I'm just keeping you covered. That's all.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
No worries. Well, I'll tell you what, we're down to 2 minutes. So leave the world with whatever you would like to leave it with.
Well, I want to leave it with an optimistic note. We're in America, and I see a very, very happy future for us. Whatever, as John said very correctly, dawn is approaching, light is here. We're a very vibrant country where we make mistakes, and that's the beauty of our country. Our country is not based on success only. It's based on the fact that I can have a failure, you can have a failure. But tomorrow is always the promise of America, that tomorrow we can do better for ourselves, we can do better for our country. And if we take care of ourselves and we take back the powers that were taken from us in the government, that is, you know, tell the IRS that's enough, tell the TSA, we don't need you. Tell the military, we don't need 2.2 million people. Tell our president, you don't need the limousines and the Secret Service. And we go back to the regional basis, less government, more employment, better education, better schools, better treatment for our veterans. We're going to do okay, but we're getting there. And it's not an easy road. As John has said, we're walking on thin ice, but I'm not sure we've ever had thick ice. And I don't see it as bad, what's happening to us. I see it as a point of struggle, which has been the history of America since its founding. We didn't have an easy birth, and we don't have an easy growing process. And so I want each and every one of you to think very positively that tomorrow's another day. You can do something about it. Listen to the issues, concentrate on them, share them with your friends. But you, as citizens of America, have to take responsibility for the actions of your own and the actions of our government. And once you protest, once you write, once you converse with your friends, this is a wonderful country, and God bless this country, yes. And I see a wonderful future.
Excellent. It's been a most enjoyable evening with you, Dr. Steve Pachenik. Come back again soon, and we'll check in with you from time to time and make sure that you do.